What's old is new again as devoted kaiju fans and cast come together for a short but sweet tribute to an important bit of lost kaiju media. Will this faux documentary, though, ring true for discerning modern audiences, or is this arrival more of a departure to the distant past? Find out along with us as we step back in time and turn black and white. This is Kaiju vs. History, The Great Buddha Arrival.
Welcome back to Kaiju vs. History. This is your historical Kaiju Wikipedia article, Miles, and joining me is a bevy of star-studded appearances, likely filmed in under an hour, Patrick. Patrick, how you doing, bud?
I got a very short window for recording this episode. Basically, I mean, if this episode could be done in between appearances at like a convention, it feels like what some of these stars are.
I feel like one actively was filmed at a convention. When they have Akira Takarada there, I'm like, this was filmed like in a conference hall 100%.
That wasn't the one, not the one that I was thinking of. I think it was.
Were you thinking of
Yukiko Kobayashi, who just like shows up on the street and like kind of points up in the sky? She was in Destroy All Monsters and
Okay. I thought you were talking about Ida when he talks about basically talks about being saved by the Great Buddha in the same way that Gamera saved him.
Honestly, that was like one of my favorite parts of the movie. I was like, that's awesome.
That's 100% my favorite part, because like some of these older guys, like I don't track as mm-hmm. easily. But when he starts talking about that sequence, I'm like, oh, that is the kid with the pet turtle. This is awesome.
We are like so excited to get to talk about this movie. Let's slow it down. We're watching the 2018 quote unquote remake of the 1934 film The Great Buddha Arrival this week. But yeah, I mean, just saying that doesn't feel right. It doesn't really remake doesn't fully encapsulate what this film is, what this film does. And it's not really a remake.
No, it's so
not really a reboot. That doesn't work either.
So it's kind of it's basically a metafictional sequel. This term was used specifically in 2014 for the quote unquote remake of the slasher film, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, which itself was a remake of a 1976 film that was more documentary style and a little bit more about the actual case, even though it did, you know, spice up some of the death sequences for, you know, film. This does kind of the same thing, where this is a fictional sequel to the lost 1934?
Yes.
Which it's been posited that this was lost during the war, possibly during an ally bombing or just
fires. There's so many pieces of media that probably were, you know, just also not properly kept. This isn't a boom of Japanese filmmaking in that era that was definitely disrupted by wartime activities. But
yes,
one year after King Kong, you know, very famously, 1933. So this movie was probably like, hey, if they can do these, Japan can make its own special effects. The Tokusatsu film.
Yeah, you get this vibe that this was heavily influential on what would become the kaiju and tokusatsu subgenres of science fiction for Japan. And like, it's tough to say sometimes, because like, you know, I know some people did see this movie that when they were making some of these movies in the 50s and 60s, but like, because no version of this film exists, it's one of those things where you're like, you're always hoping that someone somewhere has, like, because sometimes that happens. Lost movies. It wasn't until like 2012 that the 1933 disaster film Deluge, which was like one of the first depictions of like New York getting destroyed by a natural disaster on screen, was found. Like, there was a foreign version that was housed in Italy. I went through this whole disaster phase in 2020. Lord knows why. And I came across this movie that had like recently, like within the last like 15 years, been found. And so this does happen, you know, today. And so anyway, this is an idea where they are looking at the movie as an adaptation of an actual event that happened in Japan, which I think is a really fun metafictional way to both reboot and sequelize this. So it sounds crass to say this IP, but like this concept.
Yeah.
And I'm super into it because especially for me, like utilizing people throughout the actors from the all across the history of Kaiju Eiga, I think is frankly, I think it's beautiful.
Yes. And spoiler warning, the director of this film, Hiroto Yokokawa, has done since this two more kind of similar projects that really put focus on both the stars and history of Japanese tokusatsu kaiju making, his 3Y company, production company, has done some other ones that both honor and kind of emphasize some of the history of these kind of films. He's also done some short films for Godzilla projects, for anniversary Godzilla projects. But yeah, this was his first film, I believe.
I'm assuming the other two we're talking about is Nezura 1964 and the Hoshi 35.
Both of which are on our list, so we will be looking at them eventually. I think when we started this podcast, or when I guess I first started thinking about it and like getting back into kaiju movies, I don't know if there was a great way to watch The Great Buddha Arrival. I feel like only a bit of it was available online.
It wasn't until like 2020, I think, when it like kind of started becoming really available, because it's on Tubi now.
Oh yeah, amazingly accessible right now. The Blu-ray came out on by SRS Cinema in 2022.
Of course it was SRS.
Yeah. Do I own a copy? I do like go through and like order like a bunch at a time. I don't think I own this one on Blu-ray. There's, you know, some behind the scenes and like deleted scenes. It is a very feature light Blu-ray, but when we first started this podcast, or like I said, when I first started watching kaiju movies or looking up, I was like, how many are there? Apparently there's about 250. But when I added this one to the list, or I don't think I had this one on the list, because the original version of this movie was like 40 minutes long, maybe without factoring in this movie definitely has like 10 minutes worth of credits. It's definitely padded a little bit. So it was on like, yeah. It was definitely on the short film side of things, and I was like, oh well, do we want to do kind of shorts? And since then the expanded edition was released, and I think re-released in cinemas in 2020, and did add an additional 10 minutes of film. So the final edition is what we watched. If you're watching it on Tubi, that's the version there. There's still like a good amount of credits in that 60 minute runtime, but I don't know, I think it's a good short. And is this the shortest movie that we've watched so far? I'm not even, we've definitely had some like hour long films.
Yeah, we've certainly had some hour long. So I'm not really certain, because especially back in the 50s, 60s, and even some of the 70s films, some of them clocked at right around an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm happy that we got to add this to the list. I'm happy that there are physical releases. There is ways to watch this digitally, which just wasn't the case in 2021 when we started the podcast. So this movie has kind of arrived. And I think because of that, and because it has proven popular, you know, that's how we also got the physical releases of the other two films. I'm pretty sure SRS Cinema did just do a physical release for Hoshi 35.
I think you're right, or they're going to.
Oh, yeah. Maybe at the time of the recording, it's not quite out yet, but I'm pretty sure that one's on my list to purchase, because it's, you know, when we started the podcast, I think it was just like a possibility that it was going to get filmed in like 2022. But no, it did come out in 2023. And it is...
It looks like it might actually be available now.
Not to spoil too much, but it is kind of a love letter to one of my favorite actors in the Heisei Godzilla series, Megumi Odaka, who plays the, not all whole of the Heisei series, but the majority of the Godzilla Heisei series, playing the psychic Miki. And the movie is like her first film in like 20 something years. And it's about her 35th anniversary of starring in films. She was a Toho, I forget what they call it, like a contest winner, like a talent show kind of winner to be in a film. But anyway, I'm very excited to get to that one, but we got to talk about Great Buddha Arrival first, Miles. Not much change in our title here for this film. This is a Daibutsu.
Oh, yeah. Before we get any further, Patrick, what's in the title?
I mean, not a lot. I have seen it translated in a few different ways, and I had it wrong in our notes. I had it written out as Great Buddha Revival because I think it can be translated in some respects compared to the first one as a revival of the series. But I want to say they're both Daibutsu Kaikuko. Yeah. The first movie is also sometimes referred to as Daibutsu Kaikuko Hin or Chukyo Edition. Excuse me. Chukyo Edition. But for the most part, this one is just known as the Great Buddha Arrival in a few different locations. But yeah, I don't think there's much else as far as alternative titles go. This didn't get a very wide theatrical release. Like we said, it did release in Japan in 2018 and then pretty sure re-released in It's a Longer Edition in 2020. But this is a very small production. It started with a crowdfunding first round of 129,000 yen, which sounds very impressive, but that is about slightly under $1,000 US bucks. So not really blowing things out of the water here for its first round of, and I think it was kind of through a Kickstarter kind of like crowdfunding. And that was a lot less than the director, I think, needed, but was still surprised about. But when they went to their second round is when they exceeded their target of 1 million yen, which was, closer to like $8,000. They raised about 1.4 million yen, which is about $10,000. And all things being equal before the end of the production, I think this movie costs about 3 million yen to make, which is like 22K, somewhere in there, Miles. That's not a lot of money. Like, it's still a very low budget film. I was pretty excited to learn about that because, not only does this have CGI, it does have kind of recreations of period kind of tokusatsu in miniatures, in a little bit of pseudomation, not a whole bunch in trying to recreate the original black and white footage that we know exists because of really the only images of this original movie, the 1934 one, comes from like a magazine.
Right.
Pictures of the Buddha statue standing next to some building, staying next to, I think, I'm actually not sure which fortress this is. But just a couple of things that have survived. Not a whole lot. Definitely no footage, but they did a pretty cool job, I think, recreating it a little bit in this movie. Nagoya Castle is the one that the one of the few, I think, that survived. Yeah, and it does feel like this was kind of made in stages along with the fundraising. And I think what really got the ball rolling for the director was securing Akira Takarada as kind of
that'll do it.
The focal point of the film. Yes. Getting one of the original Godzilla actors on board and in a pretty important role, kind of the
bookends the entire thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, it opens with him. It closes with him. And he also tells maybe the most iconic and important lesson about kaiju movies in a very, you know, kind of plain language form for the audience. And it's great. Like everything he says, I'm just like hanging on his every word. You know, he unfortunately passed away a couple years ago, and this is like one of his last films. He was supposed to be in Godzilla 2014, I think, the legendary Godzilla, but his like scene got cut. He was supposed to be like a passport agent for like 10 seconds, and they couldn't keep it in the movie.
So I remember being so upset about that, because I'm like, you know, it's not like there was a big long scene, just let the man appear. Like,
yeah, it's just, yeah, I can't imagine it would like disrupt the flow of that part of the movie that much. But yeah, you mentioned this is a metatextual kind of reconfiguring of the original film. It does have elements of just recreating the original footage. Like the credits of the film show a pretty good representation of, I think, what the original 1934 movie could look like.
Yeah, there's some really good sequences that are shot in a way that's intended to look like a 1934 film, and they do a really good job. It doesn't feel like it's just a filter. You know, I feel like they actually used like film, like the films, like the kind of film they used in 1934 and the kind of stuff they did, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't think so, but if they did, that's amazing. If they didn't, it's still pretty awesome what they were able to achieve digitally.
Yeah, if they didn't, and this is digital effects, they did a damn good job, because it looked like, oh, it didn't look like a lot of times when you see in a movie where like there's a flashback or something and it's just a filter with some cigarette burns and some scratches on the quote unquote film. This legit feels like that kind of difficult to see film from the 30s, where like you have to kind of squint to like make out what some things are going on, you know, because of the heavy shadows and stuff. I also love the fact that like the kind of main character, it works for 3Y.
Yeah. You know, I thought for a second it was the director himself, but
I did too. I had to look it up to make sure it wasn't, but it's not.
Murata is played by Kazuma Yonoyama, who himself is cherub-like, is a little Buddha belly, which I enjoy. He just seems like an actual person that is making the movie, which is kind of
fun. I enjoyed him immensely. And the cameos in this, like my other favorite cameo, it's also, I think, Gamera-related. Mm-hmm. Yukijiro Hotaru.
Oh, yeah. So good. Playing basically his character from the Heisei Gamera films.
So good. But like not from the first one, from the other two, you know?
Yes. When he wasn't a detective
he pretends to be a detective, but like he's got the goofiness that he has in the other two movies, where in the first one, he's much more serious.
I don't know. It feels like he's directly out of the Rego or Rega films. Spoiler warning, he's going to keep doing. But yes. Yeah, there's so many cameos. I don't know if we could mention all of them, but the one that you've already mentioned besides that, Yoshiro Uchida, is
so good. Like I was kind of like, I wasn't half paying attention, but I was like, okay, we're going to have a little thing. And then when he like talks about how the Buddha like caught his hand to save him from a lighthouse, I was like, no way, this is perfect.
Yeah, so I don't think that was in the original. I think that is part of the extra footage that they filmed, and I think it shows.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that is listed at least on Wikizilla as part of the international / final edition of the film, along with additional cameos by Akira Kubo, who's another Godzilla mainstay, and a blink and you miss it, Ben Furuya, who of course is Ultraman, Ben yes. Furia plays the grandson of the director of the original Great Buddha Arrival in this movie, who in real life gave the director of this film his blessing to make. But it is funny that he's played by Ben Furia.
And he's wearing an Ultraman.
Yeah, I missed that. But supposedly, yeah, he's wearing an Ultraman pin. Those cameos do feel, like I said, like they were just filmed at a convention somewhere.
Yeah,
like,
but
really quickly.
But they're also so lovingly like executed. Yes. And like they're really, really fun. Like, I mean, I would say Yukijiro does not feel very convention-y, but it also feels like he had an afternoon.
He has a lot. Like, he's doing his own stunts. He's on a bike, you know.
Well, I know he's biking, on a bike, he's like, you get me for an afternoon, so film what you got.
in a park in Tokyo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's more. There's, you know, characters. There's English speaking actors who were in Showa era films as well. Peggy Neal, who was in The X from Outer Space. Two character actors that were in Godzilla Final Wars, Yoshihiko Otsuki and Junichiro Nirasawa, basically play the same talking heads characters from that movie as they are in this one. And they have a very funny little scene.
That conversation's so, so funny.
Yeah, bringing up aliens into this universe was very good. Yeah, and it is, I will say, it is a confusing film, but a good confusing film. Like, it is very artistically done. Like, there are parts of it I was just really hooked. Like, there's a kind of a dream sequence where our main character who's researching the story digs into this rash of suicides that happened after the great Kanto earthquake of 1923. And we get a couple of characters almost in like a trance-like state killing themselves in this black and white sequence. It's some really dark stuff, but that is one of the first parts of the film's special effects that made me go, whoa, was when the guy was like, I think about to jump off the bridge and the Great Buddha arrives in front of him. I was like, oh, wow, this is like, if I had seen that in 1934, I would have been as blown away as, you know, a King Kong kind of sequence.
Absolutely.
Some really cool stuff. And then that character comes back towards the end of the movie when maybe our main character has died and gone to either heaven or hell at the end when Murata finds himself in like a earthquake destroyed Tokyo, which, by the way, is like, did they shoot that in the wake of Japan's actual tsunami / earthquake?
I don't know.
The production value of the destroyed Tokyo was insane. I was like, where is this?
I thought it was one of the more impressive shots in the film. And I like this idea that, like, I mean, for those who don't know, like, kind of the basic story is that you have someone who is basically given an assignment to research this instance of a giant Buddha statue walking around. And within the confines of this reality, the 1934 lost film is based off of what the director saw when he saw the giant Buddha get up and walk around. And so this one investigator and some of his coworkers too are trying to get to the bottom of the story and researching it. And in the midst of that, a giant Buddha gets up and starts walking around.
Yep, it is. It's metatextual on so many levels because the movie, the 1934 movie, exists also in this universe as maybe the government covering it up, or
yes.
That the filmmaker, you know, making it based on his actual experiences, having seen the Buddha in real life. Just it's so many levels of because the movie itself is so documentary in a lot of ways, because like we start, you know, with a documentary style interview of Mr. Akira. No, Yeah, Ada, of course. And you expect just a lot more of that in the movie, and it doesn't really come. It turns into like a more classic kind of narrative film. But yeah, when it comes back to him at the end, it's when Murata is in either heaven or hell, and we see him still trying to like edit this video. Mm-hmm. And that's when he watches the final Takarada clip. It's odd, to say the least, but it is effective. I don't know.
It's odd. It's where the narrative kind of just lets go. And mm-hmm. in a way that, like, if I will say this, if you are not a kaiju enthusiast, which if you're missing this show, you at least have an interest in it. I don't think this movie succeeds for you. This is such a deep cut, but it's also like it's so in the weeds, and that is to the both the benefit and detriment of this movie. And it lives and dies based on your kaiju experience. I feel like, can you watch this without prior kaiju? Like, yeah, but I feel like the kind of dreamlike nature of the narrative could be frustrating otherwise, because it's honestly the most frustrating thing about the movie is like it doesn't really make a lot of sense. You're not really certain if what you watched the entire time has been a dream or not, or what you're watching now is a dream or an afterlife, or and I know a lot of people that sounds like, oh, well, it sounds like, you know, an interpretive thing. It's like yes and no. There's not a lot of narrative this movie. And
the characters are really there to move the basic plot forward.
And it's also an excuse to just cram as many kaiju people in as possible. And that's really like it, this is absolutely a celebration of not just what's purported to be the oldest kaiju film ever made, but, you know, it's a celebration of kaiju eiga in general. And for at the time, like it's, you know, 70, 80 year existence. And to that end, I mean, for like us, you know, you hear us gleefully talking about things. But like if I'm just trying to tell you the story, I'm like, that's where this movie kind of suffers a little bit. This script could use a little tightening in that department. But it's such a fun ride that, like you said before, like I don't think I care by and large. Because at the end of the movie, I'm still like walking on sunshine, you know?
Yeah. And that's the hard thing about this. It's like, do I want this to be a longer film? Do I want to have more of a traditional narrative or not?
I think another 5 to 10 minutes with just a little punching up of that old script would do wonders for it.
Maybe just a little bit more of.
I mean, Murata's again, we're talking the difference between a 60 and 65 minute film. Let's calm down.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though. I think it really uses its runtime effectively, because you are left wanting a little bit more. And it also, like I said, I think it just uses its budget so well. There is a good amount of special effects and interesting sequences, but beyond the dream sequences. Just very interesting ideas that supposedly the original 1934 movie had as well, because it is described as the end of the film, the Buddha going through heaven and hell in some way. Right. Like how that's represented in special effects is really anyone's guess.
It sounds like a film that David Lynch would have loved.
But yeah, it is so interesting. And yeah, it starts with Akira Takarada talking about how he was the same age as the movie. Like he was born the same year that The Great Buddha Arrival premiered in 1934. So he was 84 when this movie came out. It means that film was celebrating its 84th anniversary. Gosh. Just some really cool little history notes. And why evaluating this movie is going to be a little difficult, I guess.
Yeah.
Before we get to that, did you have a favorite scene in the film? Like
we've talked about it like twice now.
I was about to say that that Yushiro Uchida, because I don't think he did really like any other acting, that little kid. I was just so tickled pink that it exists.
Yeah.
And finding out that was filmed like after the movie had come out and only put in the international releases, it really added a lot to the film for me. I gotta say, I think Akira Takarada's final speech talking about how disaster films, monster films, horror films like Godzilla, like The Great Buddha Arrival are really important for audiences to be able to experience, because they do mimic tragedies that happen in real life. And, you know, at this point, they're only a few years after the Fukushima disaster. He talks about the Three Mile Island and in America and the Chernobyl, of course, in kind of like the same veins. Mm-hmm. It really is a nice, pretty bow kind of on his career, on the genre as a whole, and as a wrap up to the Heisei era. You know, this is like one of the final kaiju movies to come out in the Heisei era, which was obviously a huge part of kaiju eiga overall. So that part I also enjoyed a great, great deal. So yeah, let's get to rating this movie. It is an oddity, to be sure. Reboot/remake. It has got a little bit of an original story. There's documentary elements to it. And in general, just a love for the genre is represented. And there's so many of these independent Japanese, usually comedic directors that have existed in this century, kind of looking back at the genre. Obviously, you and I both really enjoyed both Kaiju Mono and Outer Man by was that Shinpei?
Is it Kurosawa?
Kawasaki, yes.
Kawasaki.
Minoru Kawasaki.
I've been watching a lot of this recently. So,
but yeah, all three of those directors, Hayashiya and Kawasaki, and now I'm very excited, like I said, to watch Hiroto Yokokawa's other two films.
Yes.
They all have such a love of both Showa and Heisei era kaiju films. And if you are listening to this, I mean, if you've gotten this far into this podcast, you probably like kaiju films too. And I think you're going to like this one. I do think it is a little half-baked. But it's like the analogy I've put in my notes here. It's like a sunny side up or an over easy egg that's just a little too runny. Like it needed. It's edible. Yeah. It's delicious.
It needed a little more cooking. I'm
just a little bit more. I wish there
that's
was.
Also like, that's also what you mean by half baked. I mean,
yeah. It just needed a little bit more time, but it's perfectly serviceable. And like I said, maybe 20 more minutes, it would have been too much. But like you said, 10 minutes. Yes.
Yeah. 5-10 minutes just to like.
That being said, if I had gone to like G Fest and this was shown there, like I'm sure people were like standing up, like applauding at the end. And
I can't imagine like kaiju fans not digging this.
Exactly. So, and there are actually some elements that I was genuinely surprised at, you know, shocked to see on the screen. And yeah, that being said, I don't think it's a very good movie. I think it is one that you definitely should experience if you're a kaiju fan. I'm going to bump up my score a little bit because I am talking so positively about it. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10 for my personal enjoyment. Puts in the kind of very good category for personal enjoyment. I think I would watch this movie again, which is kind of where I differentiate 6s and 7s for my personal enjoyment. What about you, Miles? Where are you rating this?
Yeah, so for my personal enjoyment, I'm torn. I fully agree. This is a little bit of a half-baked movie. It's the narrative does need some fine tuning. It needs some baking. It's also the one thing about this movie that just doesn't fully land. Like everything else about this movie is exceptionally well directed. The cinematography is excellent.
Yeah, for this kind of movie, it really is.
For a $10,000 movie, this movie looks great. I mean, I am shocked and inspired by the independent. You know what? I'm giving this an 8. Like the independent spirit, like for my personal enjoyment. And like as we said at the top of the show, like this is a gift for kaiju fans. And the entire time, despite the fact that I'm having like some reservations about some aspects of the actual narrative, every time I see someone or you know I see an actor that I've recently seen Akira Takarada, you know, kind of bookend this movie, and even seeing like the Buddha walk, but they're clearly using like the old style of making the thing walk. And I love that. Mm-hmm. And so for my personal enjoyment, while there's certainly parts of this movie that I do find a little ho-hum, I do find the very end to just kind of not quite land for me. I want to give this an 8. I think I do end up being very enthusiastic. I don't know how often I'm going to watch it, but it's such an awe-inspiring project to me that I can't help but be taken in by it. Like, and again, this is like, I mean, because we know a little bit about the history and the making of it, like, that does factor in for me. But for this particular aspect of the movie, for the personal enjoyment, I think I'm going to be really kind, and I'm giving it an 8. How do you feel about the technical? Because this is where I'm probably going to be a little more harsh.
So technically, I feel this movie does work on a few levels, but also it doesn't on some other levels. Obviously, the cameos are great. The cameos are the name of the game. Obviously, a lot of these actors have been used in other independent kaiju, more comedic films that we've watched over the last few seasons in the 2000s. The script is both too simple and too convoluted in different parts. So I can't imagine it would hold most audiences' attentions, because it does not hold their hand when it comes to the story that they're seeing. I don't think I would have completely understood it if I wasn't reading like a Wikizilla kind of description of what was happening. And part of that is it is Japanese. So like the end of the movie is not
explained. I didn't realize like, oh, the 9.0 earthquake happened. Oh, yes. Did it?
Because it didn't translate his phone messages like at the end of the movie. Yeah. So there's some stuff that you definitely need to be a little bit more in depth in your exploration of. But you know what that reminded me of a good deal? Demaking, the sea monster. I feel like in the same way that movie required, I mean, because that was very specifically made for a Japanese audience. I feel like just us being on the other side of the pond, there were elements of this that were glossed over very quickly, like the 1920 like mass suicides, which we didn't even get into, but it was like a crazy real thing that was happening, was like couples doing like what are they called, copycat suicides in like a very short time period, like supposedly hundreds of people killing themselves in Japan. And that might just be something that like Japanese people know about, and I just don't feel like it's really well known in other parts of the world. But you know, like the suicide forest, I think was mentioned, and some other historical events in Japan, like the great 1923 earthquake, which just absolutely devastated Tokyo. If it's the one that I'm thinking of, I'm pretty sure it is. It's the one that was pretty influential on some kaiju filmmakers we've talked about here. But the interview with Akira Takarada was probably, I feel like, secured first. And I think once you get that interview on tape, you're like, okay, we can make a movie around this, you know?
Right.
The Buddha recreation was maybe like another part of the film. And it really does feel like it was kind of put together piecemeal. But like I said, it was made for like $20,000, which it's crazy to think about. It's like I have the funds. I have that amount of funds. It's like, should I be making a movie right now? If this is the quality that can come from that effort, from that initial capital. But yeah, it technically feels like it did more with that $20,000 than almost every Asylum film that we've watched so far
together. Absolutely.
And narratively is like just as coherent as some of those, but I'm giving it a 6 out of 10 because it did achieve a lot. I just feel like there's just no meat on the bone. It needed a little bit of fat to go along with what was presented to us. And I wish there was like a third edition that they put out and just kept doing interviews of these actors and adding to this narrative. But I mean, that's pretty much probably what we're going to get in his other two films. So we'll see. But what about you, Miles? I've talked for a long time about the technical.
I am right there with you.
Okay.
I am also at a 6 out of 10. I think this script is a little wishy-washy. It does a great job utilizing the talent that they were able to get. It does a fantastic job communicating kind of the soul of kaiju films. But yeah, as a narrative piece, it kind of loses the plot quite literally several times. It is beautifully shot. It's well acted for amateur acting. Uses its budget impeccably, but the narrative does fall pretty short, and that does take away some of the impact in a very meaningful way. And I mean, I know there have been plenty of times where a script has like completely ruined a movie for me. That's not the case here, but I think it needs to be stated because this is such a razor edge film. And I think you and I are also aligned in the next segment of this, which we're going to talk about in just a moment. I think it can't be overstated how much being a kaiju fan lifts this movie for you. However, I do feel the movie doesn't do any lifting on its own in its narrative. And I feel like that's where it falls the most short. And so I'm kind of docking a lot from that alone. Everything else about this movie, it's so impressive, but it does really fall short in the movie aspect of it. So yeah, I'm right there with you, a 6 out of 10. But let's talk about the evocative nature of this, where it stands in its place in kaiju history and pop culture history, or what it does with the tropes. How do you feel about this in terms of its evocative nature?
So its importance as a kaiju movie, an 8 out of 10, is an enlightening film on our scale, and a 9 out of 10 is kind of beyond that, is transformative. And I think for the low budget independent films that we have had access to, almost all of them out of Japan, this is really the most important. You know, like this is one that I could see them wanting to play at conventions beyond like the first year it came out. You know, like this is kind of like a living historical document for the genre in a lot of ways. And it is fun. Also, it is short, yes, but is fun in a lot of ways. So much so, I'm very excited to get to director Yokokawa's other films. Like I said, I feel like all three of them are in some way about preserving kind of kaiju history or honoring or retelling parts of it. So, like I said, I think when we started this podcast, none of them we had access to. So I was like, oh, I don't know if we're going to get to Nizura in 1964. Or I don't know if Hoshi 35 is actually going to, at this point, it was still in like a fundraising phase in like 2021. But yeah, this movie doesn't narratively reinvent the wheel, but I feel like the elements of Japanese filmmaking it's trying to recreate or honor, it did extremely well. So yeah, not to be missed by kaiju fans. And I'm very happy that we were able to add it to our list, that we're able to watch it. And honestly, it is more accessible than so many other Japanese kaiju movies. You know, it's crazy that I was able to watch this on Tubi.
Tubi has got some stuff, man. Tubi is, yeah.
Did we watch Death Kappa on Tubi?
I've watched a lot of stuff in the 21st century seasons on Tubi. That isn't like directly like Gamera, Godzilla related. Well, I think most like, Asylum stuff is on Tubi.
Like this movie is easier to find than I think Big Man Japan right now, which is like crazy to say.
Wild, because that movie had such a splash when it came out.
Yes, I was about to say it was everywhere, I think, for a while. And then it just has fallen off of streaming in a few places. But yeah, I watched this on Tubi. You can too. And I suggest you do. I'm giving this a 9 out of 10 for its evocative nature as kaiju art. Actually, kaiju art for once. What about you, Miles?
Again, I'm right there with you. This is a love letter to kaiju cinema in the most pure fashion. And it's done with that independent spirit. I mean, this movie is made with virtually nothing. and it still looks great. The mm-hmm. the technical stuff they pull out is so impressive. Like, legit, if they and when I'm if they landed the script, this movie would be getting like nines and tens across the board for me.
Yeah, that's the thing. Really it is.
And I have to reiterate what you say. If you are a kaiju fan, you should absolutely watch this movie. This is a love letter to not just the genre. And I love having it bookended with like these great speeches by one of the great kaiju leading men and about what the you know, metatextually talking about what the subgenre means to film, what it means to people. And it's pure love. And I cannot stress enough like how much that carries this movie. And that's why you heard us so giddy at the beginning of it, is like this movie is just a painstaking love letter to kaiju cinema. And I think it's insane that they pulled off the stuff they did with this one. All the cameos are delightful. The film tricks they pull off are pretty incredible. Like, again, I wish this script just landed for me. I really do. Mm-hmm. Like, this would be like 8, 9, and 10s, mostly 9s and 10s, I think, across the board, if it had. But
I just want to care about the main character to like a little bit more, and then
exactly. Then but if I'm talking to people about kaiju cinema, like, this is absolutely a film that I feel like, yes, after you watch a lot of these other films, you have to see this. This is such a beautiful, just warm hug to kaiju cinema, and I can't recommend it enough to kaiju fans. This is excellent in that regard. It's such a wild roller coaster of ratings, because it's like, okay, yeah, we, because of one aspect, these two features are affected, the technical and personal enjoyment. But at the end of the day, when we talk about its importance and the evocative nature as a piece of kaiju cinema, this is at the top of the heap.
Boy, howdy. Yeah, I really wish we could watch Nezra 1964, his next kaiju movie, soon. But it is in our next season. It came out in 2020. So it's going to be in our season 8 of the podcast. So we got a ways to go. We got a few months before we can dig into it, but I want to watch it right now. And I'm hoping, because it had, I'm pretty sure, a bit of a larger budget, I think it has more of a narrative structure, which is good. But it's also on Tubi, which is so crazy. It was mm-hmm. like, there was like nowhere we can watch it just a few years ago, and now it is there to watch for all to see. Basically the same runtime. It looks like it's 54 minutes for Nezra. And yeah, I can't wait to get to Hoshi 35 as well. So for our final scores, you're at a very soft 8 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I'm at a hard 7 out of 10. Just like last week, we are going to round down, makes our podcast final a 7 out of 10. But if we were just ranking like movies that are about the love of kaiju cinema, this is like near top of that list. This is like
100%
number 1, 2, or 3. And like, I don't even know what it would be up there with, but it is definitely up there. And it's so fun because like I said, it shouldn't work, but it does. Oh, I know what would be up there. Outer Man. I feel like Outer Man is also kind of that list.
Or Tokusatsu, but like, yes.
And Ultraman, obviously. But
yeah,
it's great. It's so much fun. So 7 out of 10, but do watch it. If you're a kaiju fanatic, it's worth it. Right. So that is going to do it for this episode. You can find us all online at Kaiju Versus History, kaijuversushistory.com, social media, Kaiju Versus History, or email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail. Rate, review, comment wherever you find our shows. We'll find it. We'll read it on the air. Or feel free to just interact with us on the Cosmic Crit Discord. If you search up Cosmic Crit Discord, we have a Kaiju Versus History channel there, where we just talk about everything kaiju. and mostly post like the latest kaiju toys and
it's a lot of news and toys or Godzilla comic book news, because Godzilla lights up the comic book world these days, whether it be whatever weird IDW miniseries that they come up with, whether it's pirates or skateboarding kids in Australia, legit a real thing, or or some quirky little thing that, or whether or not he's teaming up with the Justice League and fighting King Ghidorah. Also a thing that recently happened.
We could do an entire podcast just about Godzilla comic books. You know?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So many. Like ever since IDW got the license, like in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, like it's just been insane.
License to print money. Yeah, so find us there, and you can also find our Letterboxd account if you search up Kaiju Versus History and find all of our reviews in 5-star format. So this one would be getting a 3.5 stars out of 5, right? Is that how math works? Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right, so that'll do it for the old Great Buddha Arrival. Miles, what are we doing next week?
Well, thank you, Patrick, and thank you, listeners. And we're going to catch you next week when we stick to a smaller budget Japanese kaiju film with the closing of an independent trilogy now a decade in the making. Will a bipedal kaiju-sized foe be what this wacky series needs to finish strong? Find out as it's Regal versus Holy in a monster movie for the ages. That's right. Tune in next week for History versus God Raiga versus King Oga, War of the Monsters.